Good morning, everyone. Welcome to the new city of Westminster Seminar. I think we enjoyed during July and August. It's really good to be back and to see you. And today, I'm absolutely delighted to have a story of great friends with us again to look at the history of these events from this time. It's wildly seated with the Gilded Age. And I know this will be a wonderful single seminar to get kicked off for the season. Next week, John Bruce Seminary will come to talk about faith and politics, insights from the Warren Declaration of 1934. And if you have Germany, we can see how we might learn some things that will help us. So now, please join me in giving the land a warm
You bet, although try it now.
So I'll just get started with the project. And research history in 1870. Pittsburgh in 1880, where we have a census. Pittsburgh is the 12th biggest city in the country. It had a population of 156,000 or so people, and it was increasing
rapidly, so that one decade later, in 1890, it had a population of 239,000 people. So in one decade, it went from 156 to 239,000 people. And that's the period, roughly the period that we're talking about here. So it's a period of enormous growth. And this growth is largely in the form of white immigrants, right? And so we're all familiar with this story. You know, you have massive numbers of white immigrants coming in. Many of them, a disproportionate number of them, are going to be Black, not Black, they're not going to be Black, they're going to be white young men. And those are the folks who are, you know, working aged, right? But they're also the folks who are crime aged, right? So you're going to have a lot of disorder and a lot of crime in Pittsburgh, even compared to other cities, because we had an enormously disproportionate sort of number of crime aged men. There are a small number of Black residents in the city. During this period, roughly the percentage of the population which was Black was somewhere under 3%. So a very small Black population. And those folks would fit into basically three categories. Why were Black people in Pittsburgh? Some of them were descendants of folks who had been enslaved in Pittsburgh, you know, before there was an emancipation starting in 1780 in Pennsylvania. And so we did have slavery in Pittsburgh, though not much slavery in Pittsburgh. And some of the descendants of those people remained in Pittsburgh, right? So you have some people who've been there for a really long time. Pittsburgh was also a major destination for people escaping slavery. Pittsburgh had a very large fugitive slave community, not as big as some places like Cincinnati, had an even bigger one, but it was one of the cities that had a very large fugitive slave population. So them and their descendants. And then you're going to have just a few. You don't have the migration yet. This is before the Great Migration, right, which is going to happen in the 20th century. But you're going to have just a few former slaves in the 1870s and 1880s who are going to come up to Pittsburgh in order to, you know, get those jobs working in. Sometimes they could even get jobs, you know, working in the steel mills, and but they often were not allowed to do so by the labor unions, right? So for various reasons, you have about 3% of the population, which is Black, but it's still not a big proportion of the population. So to police this population, and this image is actually from a book about the history of the Pittsburgh police, which was published in 1889. So this is actually a specific Pittsburgh image. And this is just, it was like, what is our idea of the police? What should, and it was at the beginning of this book, what is our dream of the police in Pittsburgh, right, in this period? So the idea of the police was that the police were meant to keep us safe and the police were meant to protect our property. Much of what the police did in this period in Pittsburgh, as elsewhere, and we've talked, some people attended, I talked before about the history of policing, and I said so much of what the police do is order violations, right? You know, just kind of keeping order on the streets, and that's what these police did as well. Much of what the police did in Pittsburgh as elsewhere was arresting mainly men for order violations, and so we have one representative month in Pittsburgh. A year before the introduction of Black police, Pittsburgh police arrested altogether, they arrested 185 people for drunkenness. They arrested 233 people for disorderly conduct. They arrested 20 people as suspicious. And they arrested 34 other people for other things combined, right? So just to get a sense of what police were doing, they're arresting people for drunken, disorderly, and just because, who are you? Why are you here? You look really sketchy, you know, so you're a suspicious person. Most police were patrolmen. The vast majority of them did patrols. Most of them worked at night, so that many more police on night duty than during the day. They generally reported for duty around 8 p.m. and they stayed on duty until 6 a.m. They never got a day off ever for any purpose or holiday or weekend or anything. So they were on duty every single day from 8 p.m. until 6 a.m. So I have a list of expectations for the police in the, am I moving out of my frame? No. Okay. I have a list of expectations for the police in the 1880s that was published by like police command was like, well, here's what we wish our police would do. And so this gives us a good sense of what they did and what they hoped they would do and what they were afraid they would do. Right. And so I'll just read it because I think it's really good to get a sense of policing and how it was working. Okay. Officers were expected to be physically healthy. They're expected to be literate. They were expected to be promptly obedient, punctual, and quote, neat in person and dress. They were expected to know their beat well, the territory that they policed. And through their vigilance, they were supposed to quote, make it extremely difficult, if not impossible, for anyone to commit a crime. They should stop any suspicious person they saw, and they should make sure that all doors and windows on their beat were secured. They would go around and try the doors and windows, and they would tell you if your doors or windows were not secured. They would like return dogs to where they were supposed to be. They were just like kind of like trying to keep, you know, keep everything in order in their beat, which they did every day. They were not to stop anywhere during their beat, and especially they were not to stop at saloons. And they were not supposed to talk to each other, and they were not supposed to talk to citizens, especially not with female citizens, except on police business. They were not to sleep on duty, and they were not to drink while they were on duty, and they could only smoke on duty if they were working after dark, which is most of the time. They were not supposed to swear. They were supposed to be courteous, and they were supposed to make any arrests that they did make, quote, with all possible moderation and forbearance. And finally, while they were not to interfere unnecessarily, they want to be careful not to cause, you know, interfere in people's business when they didn't need to. When they did act, they should do so with decision and boldness. So it's actually pretty, it's a really tough job to, like, you know, get all this together, but you can also see where they're falling short. You know, often they are sitting in saloons, you know, often they're chit-chatting with each other. And often they're not making arrests with decision or boldness, or they're interfering unnecessarily with people. They had very little training. They couldn't effectively call for immediate backup. So if they got into they were often by themselves, they took solo, you know, they patrolled solo and on foot. And if anybody confronted them or anybody caused them violence, or they tried to stop something or tried to arrest somebody and they resisted, they were really on their own. They were some ways they could try to call people, but not really. So they often were subject to violence. They were often, you know, injured or killed on, you know, on duty. This was fairly common. And then they also used a lot of violence. They had, and they were expected to, they had a police baton, which they called a mace. And which is, so the mace that we know is chemical mace, right? You know, so the police baton was a mace, and, they, also had a gun. They didn't have to have a gun. Some of them didn't, but, police most of the time by this period of time were carrying a gun. Okay. Okay, good. Okay, so as Pittsburgh rapidly grew after the Civil War, filling disproportionately with tough to police people, right? The number of police increased dramatically in Pittsburgh. Beginning in 1878, Black police would be an important part of that increase. So why is it that the city wanted Black policemen? So if you look at this chart behind me, I don't know how well you can see those numbers. I guess you can. If you look at the chart behind me, there was, it's going up and up and up until it gets to 1877. And in 1877, the numbers cut in half of the police, right? And the Black police are going to come in right after 1877. Anybody know, this is for all the credit. What happened in 1877 in Pittsburgh? Yeah, the Great Railroad riots, national riots, actually really almost overturned the federal government. It was very serious. They almost ran out of army to suppress this riot. and Pittsburgh was right at the center of the riot. It was one of the most important cities with St. Louis. It was one of the most important cities in the riot, burned down the Strip District. 22 people were killed, 22 rioters were killed in this riot. So it was a really big deal. But one group, Black police started becoming in right after this riot. And one of the two reasons I think Black police were attractive at this time is that one of the groups that really didn't participate in this riot was Black people, right? And they largely didn't participate in this riot because they were excluded from the unions, right? They weren't, so that they couldn't be fighting on behalf of the railroad workers because they weren't even allowed to be part of that, right? So you really didn't see Black participation in this riot, but like everybody else came out. Well, when the riot happened, the Pittsburgh police had just been cut in half because the city ran out, there was a recession, the city ran out of money. And so it literally laid off half its police. And then 2 weeks later, there's this massive riot that almost burns down Pittsburgh, and they had just laid off half their police, right? So they have to totally rebuild the force from scratch after the riot. And one thing, and the police who are left, who have just been reduced, they're not sympathetic to suppressing the riot. In fact, they side with the riot, right? They refuse to suppress the riot, and they bring in the military ultimately to suppress the riot. So what happens is after the riot is effectively suppressed, they have to rebuild the police. I think that's one reason the Black police looked good, was because they wanted to have the people that are hiring the police wanted to have police that would be not in sympathy with rioters, right? And so Black police were starting to look more reliable than white workmen, right, at this particular historical moment. So it's that next year they hire their first three Black police, 1978. The second reason, and I think it's more important, that they started hiring Black police in Pittsburgh, was because we had one of the most, as most people know, we had one of the most powerful political, urban political machines in the whole country. We had the Flynn-McGee machine, right? And it was, this city was locked down by machine politics, right? There were just a couple people in a smoke-filled room that decided how the city was run, right? And those people were Christopher McGee and William Flynn. It was machine politics, and the way that machine politics worked at this time was there's a whole bunch of different factions in the city, ethnic groups. So like there's the Italians and there's the Irish and there's whatever. There's the, you know, the Poles and the Czechs and certainly the Hungarians, you know. And the way that political machines worked everywhere was they worked with each of those factions and they said, look, if you give me your votes, we'll give you jobs. Right. And other things too, certain other forms of power, but we'll give you jobs if you give us votes. And so part of what happened was that the McGee-Flynn machine just started treating Black Pittsburghers like any other ethnic group, right? And approached them right after they got the vote, which is the beginning of the 1870s, and said, hey, can you basically be part of our machine? Black Pittsburghers said enthusiastic yes. And they were definitely willing to ally with the McGee-Flynn machine at whatever they needed to do. So the McGee-Flynn machine, sometimes it was a Republican machine, right? We were a Republican city, but occasionally the McGee-Flynn machine would want a bunch of people to switch over to the Democrats because the Republicans were saying, we're tired of being corrupt. Like we're going to have a reformist candidate. Then the McGee-Flynn machine could say, hey, you know, Black constituents, you guys vote Democrat. Right. And then you'll scare them into complying with us. Right. So they're doing all sorts of fancy things. Black Pittsburgh were willing to tightly ally with them. And so actually the very first year that Black Pittsburghers got to vote, which was 1871, they actually flipped. They flipped to the Democrats. They had literally just been like freed by, you know, Lincoln, you know, but the machine needs them to vote Democrat to help the machine candidates control the Republican Party. So they flip, like the first vote is a flip, right? So they're totally very aligned with machine politics. And so very, very useful. And the best, the biggest job that you have to give if you're the head of the Pittsburgh machine. Oh, and I'm sorry, here is the 1877 strike. The biggest job that you have, and here is J.O. Brown, who was really, they called it the Flynn-McGee machine. But do you know how there's always somebody who's really running things behind the scenes, right? It's never, it's really this guy. He was J.O. Brown. He was the head of the chief of police. And he was, I think, the most important person in the Flynn machine, the Flynn-McGee machine. He didn't have the money, but he was the person who made all the parts work out, right? And he's in charge of the police. The biggest job they had to give to Black community in exchange for their loyalty was making them police. Okay, so this is just a contemporary picture of police. I'm sad to say that one thing we don't have is the one thing I want the most, which is a picture of one of these early Black police officers, but we're gonna see one of their wives. But I cannot find a picture of them. Okay, so now we can see maybe what the Pittsburgh leadership wants from the Black police, but what is it that the Black people want from being police? And part of it is what we've just said, like they want jobs, and especially during a recession, which is what we have in the 1870s, they definitely want jobs. So that's part of what they want. But they want something else. They want dignity, right? And they want protection from violence from other groups, right? Who are competing with them. There's a historian I'm a big fan of named Matthew Guariglia. And he has argued that decisions about who to hire onto the police force in different cities made it a, quote, engine of race making. And he said, like, basically the decision of whether to allow you onto the police or not had a lot to do with determining how powerful your group was going to be in the city as a whole, right? If you could be on the police, that actually gave your whole group protection and power. In New York City, for instance, the choice to include Irish and other immigrants on the force while excluding Black New Yorkers, New York doesn't hire a police officer who is Black until 1910. In New York City, the choice to include Irish and other immigrants while excluding Black New Yorkers was part of what marked them as insiders and outsiders. Black police participated in what a historian named Douglas Flo had called, quote, the centuries-long project of constructing and fertilizing Black manhood. So part of what happens is that the people who want to become the police is that they want to be an image of a strong Black man, right, who is capable of appropriately using force, right? There's so much racism. And if you read any like Pittsburgh newspapers during this time, there's like two competing images of Black people, particularly Black men. And one of them is they're ridiculous, right? They're comic, right? It's like a minstrelesque, you know, they're ineffective. They can't do anything. Whatever they do, they mess up, right? So that's one of them. And the other one is they're dangerous, right? They're brutal. They have no mercy, right? They're rapists, right? You know, so there's these two competing images of Black men, and particularly as they use violence. Black men should not be allowed to use violence because they're irresponsible, right, is one image. And the other one, and they're ridiculous, they're incompetent. So they would like shoot the wrong people or whatever, right? And then the other image that they should not be allowed to use violence because they're just too violent, right? And that they would use it, you know, too much, right? So it's almost competing images, but both of them coexist in the minds of Pittsburghers and the nation. And so part of what Black police want to do is they want to say, is there some way that we can imagine ourselves as having power, but not being mocked, right? Having power and seeing that power as appropriate. And they do have a model of this, right? And that is the Civil War, right? One of the best things that happened to Black dignity during the 19th century was in the Civil War, when Black soldiers were allowed to participate in the Civil War, and everybody kind of agreed they did so quite credibly. And that was a moment of great pride for Black people. And it was also an incredible opportunity for them to be seen as people who are allowed to exercise power with dignity. And so this is just an image of a Civil War soldier, not from Pittsburgh. And just another image of, you know, Civil War soldiers. But in Pittsburgh, Civil War soldiers are coming back to Pittsburgh, and their Black Civil War soldiers are marching. You know, there's parades of Black Civil War soldiers. White people are coming out to watch them. Their Black Civil War veterans are being praised in the newspapers. You know, that really is a rare example of people who are truly respected in Pittsburgh are these veterans. But that is starting to recede in the past. Now the war's been over, you know, for 10 years, right? You know, how do you replenish that? And I think part of what's happening is that the Pittsburgh police are a great opportunity for Black men to say, we want to share in the power of the state. We want to have authorized violence and dignity that comes with it. And we want to do it during peacetime as well, right? And so it's actually, and we know how to get dignity. You know, it's by carrying the guns on behalf of the state. And so they're actually very, very eager. And you find people in the Black community in Pittsburgh saying, everybody wants to be a police. Everybody wants to be the police. Like, it's like the one thing that Black people, you know, Black community in Pittsburgh is sort of like most eager about. And this is just kind of a side thing, but it's one of the weirdest things about Pittsburgh during this period is that Black Pittsburghers form these jousting tournaments. They do these, you know, ever gone to like the Pittsburgh, the medieval festival or the Renaissance fair? They 100% did this every year. Black Pittsburghers, largely Civil War soldiers, came back and did these jousting tournaments, and huge crowds would come out. It was like a huge event in the city. And what they're doing is like, they're kind of being funny, like they're laughing about it because they appreciate that it's ridiculous that they're dressed up as jousters, right? They're kind of laughing about it, but the strongest young men, Black men in Pittsburgh, and there's one guy, Scott Taper, who leads all these and who's one of the, he's like always the grand marshal in the parade, and he like leads the jousting tournaments. But all the strong young Black men who are, you know, fairly prosperous within the community come out and they do these jousting tournaments. So they're really interested in various ways of like expressing their manhood and like finding dignity in their own eyes and also in the eyes of the white people who are watching them. Okay. So when Black people are given the vote, or, you know, get the vote at the beginning of the 1870s, one thing that starts happening is that in some places around the country, they do have the idea of hiring Black police. So Pittsburgh is not the only place that hires Black police, but it's actually fairly rare. So according to a book that was written on the history of Black policing, by 1878, before Pittsburgh hired its first Black police, Chicago and Indianapolis had already hired at least one Black police officer. And other cities are going to follow soon after Pittsburgh. Other cities are going to, you know, hire like one or two police officers. But Pittsburgh is going to go much, much further than that. You know, as I mentioned, New York City wouldn't hire any Black police officers until 1910. But by 1887, Pittsburgh is going to have 1/10 of their force filled by Black police officers, right? So Pittsburgh is going to have, like 28 Black police officers by this point, at a time when the Black population is 3%. So they go all in, which also means that most of their new hires, when they go to hire a new police officer, they're just going out and hiring Black police officers, like, you know, kind of every time, like they're going out and just really filling the ranks with Black police officers. So I want to talk a little bit about who these police officers are and how this works for them. So I did a lot of work this summer tracking each of these Black police officers. And the first three are in some ways the most interesting, because you remember that guy, Scott Taper, who I mentioned, he was leading the parade. He was a Civil War veteran. He tended to be the Grand Marshal, right? he becomes one of the first, and he runs these jousting tournaments. He becomes one of the first Black police officers himself. So you have this kind of like veteran. You have a guy named Jerry Grandison. And if you're a big person with Pittsburgh Black history, you'll know who Jerry Grandison is. Because Jerry Grandison is the husband of Jane Grandison, who was the nanny for the Fricks, right? So the Grandisons were probably the wealthiest Black family in Pittsburgh, right? Because they got all this, I guess, money ultimately from the Fricks. But then also Jerry Grandison ran a, what he called a rancho, a Black rancho. So he ran a saloon himself. And so he was very important within his community. But so they hire Scott Taper, this sort of hero, this sort of very manly, masculine, you know, Black man, veteran. They hire Jerry Grandison, who's this very wealthy, well-connected, and very safe for business, right? You know, he's like tied in with the Fricks. Like, and then they hire this other guy that we know a little bit less about named Dorsey Jones. Dorsey Jones is the less prestigious, but he's still a fairly, he's a Black man who is very popular with other Black men. And he also was, he was described as mulatto. He was lighter skinned. He had been a barber before the war, which meant he was working with elite whites, cutting their hair, right? And so he also had these like connections with white people as well. So they brought in these three people to be the first police. Other police are going to follow in very much in that same pattern. They're going to be, other Black police are going to be very elite within the Black community. They're going to have closer ties with white people. They're going to be seen as safe, but they're also going to be very politically active within the Republican Party. So how did Black police act once they became police? Unfortunately, they weren't any better than the white police at the time in that, you know, they were, you know, we have a lot of evidence they were extremely violent, right? You know, one of my favorites, and I guess we should never laugh about this, but there was an Oompa band. There was a German Oompa band, and Scott Taper took offense at where they were playing. He didn't think they were playing at the right place, and he just went in and beat them. You know, I mean, he just went in with this club and, you know, committed police brutality on this Oompa band, which it should not be funny because police brutality is not funny. But there was just something about like the, you know, he just, you know, beat them in the head with his club, and there was a whole like case, you know, and there was, it was a big deal. So, you know, but that was very, you know, as far as I can tell, I can't see any particular difference between the behavior of Black police and white police. And Black police, whenever there was policing to be done of the Black community, and the Black community was very much over-policed at this time, as you'd expect, right? Black police did that policing. So they did put Black police to police Black people, right? But there were so many Black police, right, that they, that was not a large part of what they were doing, right? They were policing everybody. They were arresting white women, right? You know, they were arresting rich white men, right? They were literally out there exercising the power of the state in, as far as I can tell, very much the same way that white police were. And what was most fascinating to me is that when they're talked about in the newspapers, when they say, oh, like, you know, this, you know, it was hard for me to find the Black policemen because the newspapers didn't mention their race. And I would have expected they would have, like, starting in the 20th century, if there's a Black policeman, he's going to be called a Black policeman, you know, in the Pittsburgh papers and everywhere. But during this time, they're just like, policeman Scott Taper arrested this, or, you know, policeman, this person, you know, arrested this guy, never mentioned their race. Or when they say, oh, here's the hiring list for all the policemen this year, they're not going to mention their race. So it's actually kind of hard to track them down. But as far as I could tell, I'm not saying there wasn't a lot of racism against the Pittsburgh Black police officers. So surely there was. But it's actually really surprising to me. Some of the markers of racism that I would have expected to see are absent. So at least it was a different kind of racism. And they were kind of allowed to do their thing, just, you know, just like other white policemen, as far as I can tell. And I'm going to give an example of this. Okay. No, I'm not. I'm going to do one thing before I do that. Let's see. Okay. So for the question of how did this work, like for the Black community, I feel like at least for a period of time, they kind of got what they wanted. Like they, you know, they got lots of jobs. You know, the policemen seemed to be integrated fairly well into the force, right? You know, everything wasn't perfect, but generally speaking, it was more equality than I would have expected to see at this period. And how did it work for Pittsburgh itself? And then I'm going to get into two stories to kind of complicate this, but it seemed to work really well for the machine, right? You know, 1889, right at the end of this period is when they built that spectacular jail, you know, that we all know downtown, the Richardson buildings. You know, this is a period of great prosperity for them. Their, you know, the police commissioners are extremely powerful. Yes. Yes. The Richardson building, that's the jail and the courthouse, you know, that big old stone. Yeah, it's the H.C. Richardson. Yeah, the H.C. Richardson building, which you can see that's the oldest picture I could find of it. Okay, so I have two stories to exemplify, kind of complicate this, I guess, or exemplify it, how well this worked. And one of them is a story about, it's a terrible story. So in right at the end of this period in 1889, the sheriff of a county in South Carolina, it's called Edgefield County. And it was one of the areas where the Ku Klux Klan had been. There's no longer a Klan during this time, but it was one of the places where the Ku Klux Klan had been most strong, right? It's extremely violent, a place where just white people killed Black people at just really high rates, even compared to the rest of the South, right? It was a very dangerous county and a very dangerous time. So the sheriff at Edgefield County in 1889 sends a message to the chief of police in Pittsburgh. And he says, you have a fugitive from justice. There's a man, a 24-year-old young Black man, whose name is Reverend E.F. Fleming. And his name is really John Yeldell. And he is wanted for killing a white man in Edgefield County. And we need for you to send him to us so that we could try him. And the Black community in Pittsburgh like freaked out. You know, they went and arrested him. The police did go and arrest him. And the sheriff said, you know, actually contacted the sheriff of Edgefield County, contacted the governor of Pennsylvania and said, I'm afraid they're not going to send this guy down. I'm afraid that they won't be willing to send him down. You need to make it happen. And so negotiations happened behind the scenes with like the governor of Pennsylvania and the governor of South Carolina. And the Black community in Pittsburgh is protesting. They're in the newspapers. They're like going to the police officer. They're like trying to get him released. And they're saying, you can't send him to the South. He'll never get a fair trial. They'll kill him. And you can actually see the reporting on this. There's one Black man that like runs, you know, he talks to a reporter and he says, he puts his hand around his neck. And he says, if we send him to them, they will kill him, you know? And they're just like, you know, they say one man is screaming at the top of his lungs. You can't send him back there, right? Leading this charge is like Scott Tabor, right? And these other, several of these other people who are these police officers are able to communicate with the Pittsburgh police leadership and the Pittsburgh machine leadership, right? And kind of say, you need to protect this man. What ultimately happens, we don't know exactly how much influence that had, but I think maybe it did, right? What ultimately happens is they send this man, who is John Yeldell, that is correct. He is the one that's wanted for murder. But he had killed, it had been a group of white men had been chasing a group of Black men. And the Black men had shot back in self-defense, it seems like. And then had ultimately lost. But one of the Black men had escaped, ran to Pittsburgh and changed his name. The other Black men had been killed, right? You know, by the whites, and except for one of them was allowed to live, and he named the one that escaped as the shooter, right? So it was very, to say the least, very, very sketchy, right? So Yeldell goes down there, and they bring this really powerful lawyer. They send this really powerful lawyer from Pittsburgh who had used to live in the South and is connected to wealthy Southerners with him. And when they get down there, he meets with the governor of South Carolina. The two of them go into the courtroom. The case falls apart. The judge trying the case is like, doesn't call the right witnesses. The witnesses don't show up. And they find him innocent immediately, like really quickly. There's a lynch mob of whites forms around the place, and they're gonna try to lynch him. And the law enforcement of Edgefield has been given its marching orders that he's supposed to get out of there. And they manage to get him out. He goes back to Pittsburgh. Everything is fine, right? And I take that as like an example of like kind of what the Black community in Pittsburgh gained, right? From this sort of alliance with powerful white Pittsburghers, right? It's that kind of protection that was just like one of the most powerful examples. And then the second example I have of kind of how far this went, there's a police officer, a Black police officer named William Robertson. And there's a lot of detail here that I won't share with you, but William Robertson in 1887 actually shoots and kills an unarmed white man. It's complicated, right? There's reasons why he might have been afraid for his own life, you know, and that's the defense he made, right? But he shoots and kills an unarmed white man. And during broad daylight, who had like challenged his authority. And he goes to trial. And what do you think happens? I mean, I was like on the edge of my seat because I didn't know what was going to happen. As I'm reading through these newspapers, like, what are they going to do with this guy? What are they going to do? He totally gets off, right? He totally gets off. He, you know, they're like, look, he was, you know, he was scared. He was afraid for his life. You know, these things happen. You know, it's important. He has the power of the state, right? And he's allowed to plead to manslaughter. You know, so he doesn't totally get off, but he gets almost nothing. You know, but what I think that this all says is that in fact, this was an experiment that Pittsburgh does. Pittsburgh goes a little bit differently than other cities for kind of unique reasons, you know, having to do with our labor history and our machine, that we actually really went a different direction than a lot of different places. And for a period of time, it kind of like, we modeled a different kind of system other than segregation, right? And the system, at least within Pittsburgh, sort of worked. Now, what's going to happen is that ultimately it's going to fall apart after the 1880s. The situation is going to change. Circumstances will alter, and we'll go back to having, we never have no Black police on our force after that, but we're going to go back to having very few Black police on our force. But I do think that why this matters is that Pittsburgh was trying out a very different way, a very different system, and it could have worked. It did work for a while. It could have worked. And, you know, even though ultimately they're kind of, you know, in the same way, ultimately that Edgefield has to change their racial, regime, right, to sort of accommodate, to become more similar to that of the rest of the country, right? You know, they're kind of forced to kind of ramp back a little bit on the lynching, right? In the same way, Pittsburgh, I think, is sort of pulled into the sort of national norm after the 1880s, you know, by various kinds of forces that I could discuss at greater length. But anyway, I thought this was a fascinating story and one that possibly make Pittsburgh look a little bit good, you know, relatively speaking, right? In terms of, you know, our willingness to incorporate Black police. So thank you. Yes.
What did the change that occurred?
I was wondering if the change that happened in the late 80s was based upon, well, we don't need your votes so much. So thanks a lot for helping us in the past, but
Yeah, no, part of what happened, I think that's exactly what happened, is the Flynn McGee machine got so powerful that they no longer needed this 3%, you know, which was so crucial to them. I think that is part of what happened. Yes, definitely.
I was interested in your comment because it was a question that I had about whether or not the Black policeman could work in non-Black neighborhoods. And that's fascinating, especially in light of the vote in the mid-2020s here in Pittsburgh, that Blacks were not considered hospitable and welcome into the city. But my question is, would that not have been one of the few places where Blacks could exercise some power vis-a-vis anyone else, rather than only within their own Black neighborhood? In other words, if they're going into, you know, Black, non-Black neighborhoods and arresting and monitoring and so forth, because in other neighborhoods, it's usually, I want to say, peer on peer, race on race in that way. And I think that's really unique, if I'm hearing you correctly.
Yes, no, it's totally unique. I was shocked. I was actually, that's the thing, is that I very rarely, as a historian, had worked, you know, for quite a while as a historian of this period, I was really shocked that they were allowed to do what they were allowed to do. I mean, you don't want to be, you know, but they would even, there's like one situation of like a poor white woman was, she had a cow like in Pittsburgh. She had her cows in Pittsburgh that she was trying to bring down the city streets to a meadow, right? Like, and he was like, you can't, you're not allowed. And she was like, rude. You know, she was like, you can't tell me what to do. And he dragged her into the court for being rude to him. You know, he said, you're not allowed to like mouth off to me, lady, you know, and dragged her in. And he didn't win. She didn't get punished, but he didn't get punished either, right? You know, it was kind of, the judge is like, just guys, you know, stop it, you know, whatever. But, you know, so it was really interesting how well, you know, how much they were allowed to do this. It really, that's why the more I think about it, it really was a competing model to the sort of what was beginning to happen nationally, I felt. Yeah.
Can you remind me when Reconstruction was deconstructed?
Yeah, it's 1877. So it's right before this. Yeah.
Right. I would just speculate that there's an element of regression that said, yeah, we got to put them back in the bottle.
That there's, oh.
In other words,
yeah,
taking apart the role of Black policemen in, you know, in a fairly, on fairly equal footing, had something to do with the sort of national compromise that said, maybe giving them too much too fast wasn't such a good idea.
No, and that's actually one thing I started to realize with this this William Richardson Robertson shooting, which I was not expecting, was so shocking. With this William Robertson shooting of the white man, one thing I started to see, which I hadn't seen before, was that even though the judge, who was they're all machine judges, right? You know, so the judge was like, hey, he's operating, he represents the state, he's allowed to use the violence that he's been given by the state, you know. But the newspapers were saying, for the first time I had seen in relationship to policemen, maybe the problem is that he's Black, you know, maybe as a Black man, he's not ready to have this kind of authority, and instead he should be the one being policed. You know, and you start seeing that kind of language. And I think one thing you do get is, you know, segregation is something that really starts in the 1890s, right? You know, even, you know, nationally, it wasn't as you know, segregation is a thing of the end of the 19th century. So one thing you're getting is, you're getting a new buffed up Darwinian, you know, idea about racial difference, a kind of a new form of racism. But yeah, no, I think you're right.
I just distinct memories in the 70s of being taught in middle school in the South about Reconstruction being an utterly corrupt enterprise where, cartoonish Black characters took over the government in the South, and it took years to fix that ridiculous proposition.
Yeah. Well, and I didn't, one thing I didn't mention is where there really were Black police first, right, was in the South, right? But I'm almost not counting them because they were imposed by, you know, union, you know, leadership in great numbers, right? But they were widely considered a great failure. Even in the North, they were considered a great failure. So I was really just talking about like the Northern police, but yeah, I know that Black police were part of the sort of condemnation of the Reconstruction project. Yes.
Around the time you're discussing, were the compensations for Black policemen and white policemen alike? Another thing is, were there Black people on juries? And another thing, you had mentioned unions. Were Black people allowed to join unions?
Yeah, compensation was identical. Compensation was identical. Black people were not so much allowed to join unions. There's some exceptions, but generally speaking, they were not allowed to join unions, and policing jobs were not as well paid as union jobs. They were as like, you know, steel jobs, you know, that policing jobs were like pretty good jobs. They were better than non-skilled jobs, but they were not at the same level of union jobs. And you had a third thing in the middle. What was it? Oh, they were, Black people were allowed to serve in juries and did. And in fact, some of these police I noticed were selected at times for grand jury. So like, you know, yeah, they were. So, I mean, that's one thing we often think. We think that history is like a move towards more and more rights and progress. But I think, you know, sometimes you get more rights and then they're taken away. And, you know, like I said, after this period, there's always going to be at least one, as far as I can, in fact, I know for sure, there's always at least one Black police officer every year, you know, at least up till 1920, which is when you'd expect there wouldn't be. But there's usually just like one or two as you get to those later periods. So it's, they're going to retrench after this. It's not going to, they're not going to stick with this experiment. Yeah. Well, thank you.
Thank you very much. Governance.